Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, November 7th, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember that our shows are all archived on DrSaputo.com and on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
And you're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. Now, we've got another great show for you today. It's going to include, you know, the FDA is really proud of itself for getting drugs to market faster. You think that's a good idea? We'll clue you in.
And can you acquire a resistant microbe in your hospital room left from the previous patient?
And if you're taking this drug, you better think twice if you're going to take aspirin or some non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug.
And how can we change our genetic predisposition to obesity?
And what about person-centered care? Does it do anything? And much, much more.
Plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have any questions about our topics or your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
So we're back to Occupy Wall Street. It's still moving. It's been more than a month. Lots of activity. It's become a global movement, and it's growing. And what we've got is the 99%, the middle class, okay, and the poor that are finally outraged to the point where they're trying to create a revolution, which I support. I want to be part of that revolution. But I'd like to take it a little bit further. It's not just about wealth or materialism.
And marching or hanging from bridges.
That's really, it's not just about that. But I think that's a necessary step because what we've got is finally, we realize we have a political process that doesn't serve us, that's got unemployment that in outrageous proportions. We don't have hospitalization or health care that really serves us well. And a lot of people are just struggling. And finally, I think we've had enough. But what we haven't done is paid enough attention to the Federal Reserve. That is the culprit that if we don't deal with, we will not get through this thing making much change.
I think a lot of people don't even realize that it's not a government-run enterprise.
It has nothing to do with the government. What it is a private, okay, private lending institution that prints money for us and lends it to us. And in return, we have to pay it back. And we now have a debt that is unsustainable. And we've got an economy that's falling flat. And until we take back that the printing of the money and the control of the money and back it with something that's real, like gold or silver, we put the gold back in Fort Knox. That would be a great thing for America.
I wonder if it would work for us to just go bankrupt. I mean, we really can't afford it.
It's what I would recommend. I think we should default on the debt to the Federal Reserve. They got plenty of money from us. We should start a new system of us controlling the money and backing it with gold and silver. And I think then we would have a system where we would be able to control things a lot better. And then maybe if we elected people to Congress, they might be able to support some of the things that we want. We have to be in control of the purse strings, we can't be in control of what happens.
Also, do you think that it's the 99% against the 1%, really?
No, I don't. I think it's 100%. It's all of us. It's the oneness. And that's one of the things that's being lost in the revolution that we're trying to create. Indeed, we need a revolution to get things moving, but we have to remember that the underlying important principle is that we are one, and our enemies are part of that. And they're not really our enemies when you look at things at a deeper level. And we need to find a way to forgive and forget. And a lot of people are not in that position yet, and I understand that. But if we're going to move from revolution to evolution, we're going to have to do something to raise our level of consciousness to a higher level, which means we have to want to give more than we want to take. We want to share. We want to be involved with love. We want to support a community that will support us. All those things are what we really want. It's not about having stuff. Not about better cars. It's not about better houses.
We'd
it's,
like better health care, though.
Well, that would be part of the deal. I mean, if we were really a big village, you know, like the Native American village, everybody would have a responsibility to the village. And the village, the whole thing, would have a responsibility to each person. And that's what we need to move back to, in my opinion. That's moving to a higher level of consciousness. That's real evolution, rather than the revolving around revolution, which is what we've done for thousands of years, and basically evolved very little.
Well, what do you think is going to happen with the one we've got going on right now? Because, like, for example, it seemed like at the beginning there wasn't much in the news media about it, except for you could find it online. And then when there was Occupy Wall Street in Oakland, California, and got up to like 7,500 people out there. That got a little attention.
It got a lot of attention.
And then when there were some people that invaded the group that started to vandalize a few things, that's when it kind of went sour.
Well, it's not just about standing up and saying no to the system the way it is. You have to have a plan, okay, that's deeper than just saying, we're not going to put up with this anymore, because how do we actually really stop it? What's interesting is we've
control that many people.
Though? Well, what we've done is we've worked out a system whereby we've got our neighbors and friends who are in the 99% trying to stop us through the police force, through the government, through Congress, through lots of things. And what we should be doing is finding ways to support one another. And that is going to take an evolutionary process where we think about how we're going to take care of each individual, whether they're in the 1% or the 99%. Now, I realize at the level we're at the level of consciousness we're at, revolution is the only answer. We absolutely need the revolution, and I want to support that, and I'm part of it. But I think this other part is important as well. And unless we do something to evolve to a higher level of consciousness, the long-term effects of this will not be much. If you want more information about this, go to drsaputo.com, and on there is a new piece. It's called Occupy Wall Street Requires Both Revolution and Evolution. You put that in the search box, you can get to the video. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health or you have a comment about what we're talking about, give us a buzz and we'll include you.
The FDA is bragging that the U.S. approves drugs faster than other countries. Now, is this something that's really safe?
Well, this is something that's outrageously stupid. And they're bragging about it. They say, yeah, we get our drugs to market faster than Europe does. Well, what does that say about how that process gets done and what it means?
Well, to me, that sounds like we're just all a bunch of guinea pigs. Anybody that takes those new drugs that have been fast-tracked through, and, you know, some of them, they're claiming that these new drugs are advances, you know, like they want to speed them into.
Well, occasionally that's true, but the bulk of them are just lookalikes for other drugs. And do we really want to bring more drugs onto the market that haven't been tested well? Because look at it this way. When we get drugs approved faster than Europe does, it means we've fast-tracked them. And what does that mean? It means that we've accepted user fees from the drug companies, which amounts to one-third of all the income that the FDA gets. That gives a lot of power to Big Pharma, because the FDA wants that money. And so they tend to cooperate with them and tend to approve drugs faster. They say by taking a quicker look at it rather than making them wait. But we know what's really happening.
Well, it sounds to me like the other countries are more cautious than what we are.
Well, that
and
would
we're
be
more, and we're more about money than what they are.
That would be a good thing. And would you really want to trust the data from Big Pharma by itself when it has a clear reputation of lying, presenting data in ways that's not scientific, at ghostwriting articles, at coming out with statements that are totally slanted to the advantage of the product they're trying to promote? Would you really want to depend on that information?
Well, are there representatives from the drug manufacturers that are allowed on the FDA committees?
Absolutely, and they have votes. They're about 20%.
See, that's a huge conflict of interest right there.
Well, it is. I absolutely agree.
Representatives
from Big Pharma should be on those committees. They absolutely should be. But they should never, ever, ever, ever have a vote. If it's the information we want from them, let them present
it. To ask questions.
Yes. For that, good, because we want to be educated. But we also want to not have them stacking up their votes, because we know when push comes to shove, when things get tight, what happens is that they tend to vote to support their drug. Could you imagine what would happen if a drug rep who was on an FDA committee voted against bringing that drug forward? What would happen on Monday when they went back to work? They get nailed. And so it's the clearest conflict of interest we have. And the FDA's comments about, oh, well, we have to have that kind of information is true. But the morons, I guess we're the morons because we've allowed it, are trying to convince us that that's an okay thing and that they should have a vote as well. That's absolute corruption.
You know, last year we approved 34 out of 35 new drugs, and we fast-tracked 22 out of 35.
Well, you got to give credit to Big Pharma for being able to get into that position. And you have to give credit to them for convincing Congress that it would be fine for them to fast-track drugs and to pay for it. Because now, when that income comes into the FDA, they've learned to depend on it, and those people whose jobs are being paid for by that certainly are not going to want to lose their jobs, particularly in today's economy where jobs are tough. So fast-tracking a drug, getting them on the market sooner, dumb idea most of the time. Once in a while, if we had a panacea drug that was a really big deal, okay, we could take a careful look at that. But in general, not a good idea. I'm opposed to it. I think I'm appalled at it, actually.
Well, too, it really is clear that we're the guinea pigs.
No question.
We're the laboratory rats is what we are if we're taking these new drugs that haven't been tested long enough.
Well, that's ultimately true with every drug that comes out.
Yes,
it has
it
to be true. And that's why we wind up with some of the drugs that are on the market. When you see about 20 or 25% of the drugs that come out on the market will eventually have a black box warning, which means that they are dangerous, much more dangerous than originally thought, or they will be taken off the market. That's telling you something. The controls are a big deal. And when you look at what that means in terms of deaths, look at it this way. Every year, there are 400,000 deaths caused by pharmaceutical drugs. 400,000. That's from the expected side effects as well as the unexpected ones and the ones that are misused.
That doesn't get in the news media.
Not much.
You don't put crosses on a hill for that.
Well, you've got a good point there. So I think the FDA needs to be cleaned up entirely. The money that comes in user fees should go to something other than the FDA. No money should be going directly from Big Pharma to the FDA because that's giving away our power. They should always be on committees to give information. They should never have a vote. That's how I feel about the FDA and fast tracking. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
When we go to the hospital because we're sick, I mean, we're hoping to get better, not to pick up an antibiotic-resistant infection, which is happening too frequently lately. And we already know about the MRSA, the MRSA, and the Enterococcus and the C. difficile. But tell us about this new pathogen that's being spread around hospitals that's resistant to many of the antibiotics.
Well, it's just another fancy name, and it's one more bug. And it's got a big, long, old name called Acinetobacter baumannii. And really, you can forget that. What you want to remember is MRSA, the methicillin-resistant staph. You want to remember C. difficile enterocolitis. Those are the two big guys that we worry about that cause 100,000 deaths every year, 100,000 deaths every year, and 1.7 million infections that are called nosocomial or hospital-acquired infections. That's how bad it is. They're
so
all
these
over
are
the
all
place.
Resistant to the antibiotics.
They're multi-drug resistant microbes.
And we've created them by giving too many antibiotics.
That's certainly true. And that's why we have them today, is because we overused them years ago. We absolutely overused them. So now we're in a place where when we study the rooms where people have had these infections, and we look at them 2 months later, they're still growing traces of these microbes from the rooms.
Because they can't kill them.
No. And that involves 5%. 5% of all hospitalizations in this country. You'll go in with no infection and come out with one of these infections. That's a terrible thing. It wasn't like that years ago, but it is today. Now, years ago, they used UVB lights. I remember when I was going to medical school, all the operating rooms would have UVB lights on them when there was nobody in that room. Why? To kill all the bugs. And now we know there are things like copper, okay, that is amazing at killing microbes. In fact, they kill copper. No bugs can live on copper more than about a minute and a half, about 90 seconds.
And you know what? It would probably save the hospitals money in the long run if they would just go ahead and make copper surfaces rather than to wait for people to get sick and all the money it costs, if you're just talking about money, to try to cure these people.
Well, that's really right. And where do you find them? You find them on supply cart drawer handles, on floors, on telephones, on infusion pumps, on ventilator touch pads, on bed rails. All these
the
places.
TV what, control.
Yes.
The when bedside table.
When this was tested in a clinical trial, in the ICU, where we had these kinds of infections there, 97% of the growth of all bacteria was stopped, and the number of infections decreased by 40%. Now, you would think that would be a very motivating approach to try and stop these infections from affecting people who come in uninfected.
The other thing I'm wondering about here is where hand sanitizers fits in with this. Because, you know, a lot of these hand sanitizers do the same thing. They're causing resistant infections to the hand sanitizers. And when you were in the hospital, I never noticed one person go in the bathroom and wash their hands with soap and water. They all used the hand sanitizer.
Yeah, and it's not healthy for them either, and it's not healthy for the patients.
What I mean.
And we have so many toxic exposures when we're in the hospital with various kinds of cleaning agents and detergents and soaps and bad razor blades. I mean, it's amazing how they don't think of the things like that they call little. And when you're in the hospital, you need all the detoxification capacity you have, because it's absolutely essential that we be able to detoxify when we're sick. And then you add these loads on top of it, and you're really adding to a problem that's a colossal problem. And it's time for Vicki's 2020 tip, and we'll be back taking your calls at that time.
Well, Alan Simpson, a senator from Wyoming, and he's the co-chair of Obama's Deficit Commission, he calls senior citizens the greediest generation, as he compared Social Security to a milk cow with 310 million teats.
Oh, my goodness.
So there is somebody from Montana. Her name is Patty Myers, and she says, I'm sorry. But I'm saying I'm sorry because I took some of the profanities out of what she said. But, you know, you can probably figure out where to put them back in, because our government acts like we're just stupid to accept what the government is stealing from us. But anyhow, Patty Myers is from Montana, and this is what she has to say to Alan. She says, as a career politician, you've been on the public dole for 50 years. I've been paying Social Security taxes for 48 years, since I was 15 years old, and now I'm 63. My Social Security payments, and those of millions of other Americans, were safely tucked away in an interest-bearing account for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Until you political pukes decided to raid the account, give our money to a bunch of losers in return for votes, thus bankrupting the system and turning Social Security into a Ponzi scheme that would have made Bernie Madoff proud. Now, recently, you, this meaning this senator, and your ilk pulled the proverbial football away from millions of American seniors nearing retirement and moved the goalposts for full retirement from age 65 to age 67. Now you and your shill commission is proposing to move the goalposts yet again. Okay, she also says, I and millions of other Americans have been paying into Medicare from day one, and now you propose to change the rules of the game. Why? Because you idiots mismanaged other parts of the economy to such an extent that you need to steal money from Medicare to pay the bills. Now, I and millions of other Americans have been paying income tax our entire lives, and now you propose to increase our taxes yet again. Why? Because you spent our money and just kept on spending it even after you ran out of money. Now you come to the American taxpayers and say that you need more to pay off your debt. And now to add insult to injury, you label us greedy for calling on your incompetence. Well, I have a few questions for you. Okay. How much money have you earned from the American taxpayers during your 50-year political career? At what age did you retire from your pathetic political career? And how much are you receiving in annual retirement benefits from the American taxpayers? How much do you pay for your government-provided health insurance? What cuts in your retirement and health care benefits are you proposing in your deficit reduction proposal, or as usual, have you exempted yourself and your political cronies? It is you and your political co-conspirators called Congress who are the greedy ones. It is you and your fellow nutcases who have bankrupted America and stolen the American dream from millions of loyal, patriotic taxpayers, and for what? Votes. That's right, sir. You and yours have bankrupted America for the sole purpose of advancing your pathetic political careers. You know it, we know it, and you know that we know it. Now, take that to the bank.
So right.
From Patty Myers of Montana.
Well, you know, good old Montana. I spent a couple of years there when I was in the Air Force. It was actually not a bad time. I was drafted back in about 1966 when I was just starting my residency, and of course that was the Vietnam War. And I was stationed in a little place called Glasgow, Montana for about 2 years. And it wasn't the worst part of my life, even though it was kind of remote. At least I didn't wind up in Vietnam, and things worked out. Anyway, Patty, thanks for that. That's really good advice and good comments to make. We definitely need to do something about the feds. The Federal Reserve needs to go. We just need to get rid of it. And you know, presidents have tried to do that in the past, and they've been assassinated for it. There's a tremendous amount of power that comes from the Fed that we know very little about. And when you think about it, isn't it insane that this country uses a private treasury that lends us money, dictates interest rates, and really manages our life financially and controls all kinds of things? I say let's get rid of them. Let's default on the debt. Let's reorganize our country and start out from scratch. And we will be wealthy instantly because we have lots of resources. Jobs will come back, and we need to have it all on a gold standard. Well, these are the kinds of things that we need to be looking at. It's one thing to be outraged and not have solutions to it because we've had to deal with these morons in Congress for a long time and with the feds, the Federal Reserve, who does what they want with our money, doesn't need to tell us one thing about what they do with it, and can withhold information so there's nothing transparent about it at all.
And we've earned our health care.
Well, our health care, we've also earned our wages. And here we are in the situation we're in. We need to take action. I think that Occupy Wall Street should be looking more at the feds, more at starting a new government that doesn't have responsibilities to the Federal Reserve, which is his private blood-sucking organization that's draining the financial life out of America. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
If you're taking an antidepressant and you take an aspirin at the same time, you know, with it, it can increase bleeding, that's like hemorrhaging, 42%. Now, we already know that aspirin alone can increase your risk of bleeding, and antidepressants alone can increase your risk of bleeding. So, in other words, putting them together increases your risk of like GI bleeding and hemorrhagic strokes and so forth. And the thing that's troubling here is that this is often what cardiologists prescribe to their patients that have had a heart attack.
Exactly.
Because a lot of patients that have had a heart attack have a tendency to clot, so they tell them to take an aspirin or a baby aspirin.
Well, it
helps
prevent another heart attack.
And many
That's
of them
right.
are depressed, so they give them an antidepressant.
Exactly. And look at the antidepressants. First of all, the damn things don't even work better than placebo. There was a huge study done, I don't know, about a year ago, that showed that there was no benefit from taking any of the SSRI antidepressants over placebo. So why don't we use a sugar pill? Because look at the side effects that we have from SSRIs.
Some of it is that the reason is because they're focusing on the effect of the depression rather than the cause of the depression.
Well, they're still no better than placebo.
That's why.
That's why?
Yeah. Because
no, that's not why. The reason why is because they don't do a damn thing to deal with the depression in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't change it any better than a sugar pill does.
Yeah.
And so the problem with that is now you've got all the side effects. What about the thinning of bones and the increase in fractures? What about the suicidal ideation and suicide rate? What about the sexual dysfunction that's typical of it and the atrial fibrillation that can occur and the sleep disturbance that occurs in 15 or 20% or the weight gain? Why in the hell would you want to take a pill that does that when you could take a placebo that does this, all those things without any side effects?
And then it can increase the risk of a stroke by 45%. That's pretty high.
Well, you know, we've got some problems with our thinking here, and we're so vulnerable to what the direct-to-consumer ads say and what Big Pharma promotes, that we just go along with it.
Well, and also doctors many times will just off the top order an antidepressant for somebody that has high blood pressure.
Well, they do it for a lot of...
Because they figure they're stressed and give them that.
They do it for a lot of things.
This is where people need to learn, though, to learn about it themselves so that they can say no or make a choice themselves. You don't have to do what your doctor suggests.
Well, your doctor is your teacher. Your doctor is not not making decisions. You hire your doctor, and your doctor is your employee. And if that doctor doesn't teach you and educate you about what you need to know, then you probably need to get rid of that doctor. I mean, I sure as hell don't want doctors telling me what to do. And what I've gone through with my hip surgery was a nightmare. I had to burn bridges to light my way by firing doctors who were insisting that I should sit back and leave the driving to them. And it was like, you know, as long as I'm alive, doctor, you will never, ever, ever make a decision for me. I will make 100% of the decisions as long as I can. I will thank you very much for your information. I will pay you for that. But I am not paying for you to make decisions about what I do, especially since I'm at least your equal as a physician.
Well, not only that, a doctor's supposed to be working for a patient. So you're supposed to partner with your doctor.
Well, wouldn't that be nice? And we'll be talking about that a little bit later in the show.
But also these antidepressants, they can even accelerate arteriosclerosis, so that thickens the walls of your blood vessels.
Well, there's lots of interesting things that don't come to mind a lot of the time. It's time for a station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Spooner here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we'll be back taking your calls after a short break. Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Spooner with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. If you'd like to join in our conversation or have a question about your health, give us a call.
We talk about person-centered care at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek, so it's refreshing to see that they practice person-centered care in Sweden. So tell us about what it is and about this Swedish study on patient-centered care.
Well, they took a look at what it was like when we paid more attention to what our patients wanted and we listened to them, and we didn't just treat them like they were the gallbladder in room 422, but they're actually a person who had a gallbladder problem. it makes a huge difference in how people feel. And when they looked at hospital stays, they found they could shorten them by about a third, which means people feeling better sooner and that they're
less likely to pick up an infection.
That's true. And not only that, they're feeling good about what they're getting. And we're saving money at the same time. So it's like a win-win-win. Why wouldn't you want to do something like that?
So what is the role of an MD in their relationship with the patient in this person-centered care?
Well, it gets all messed up because we're not taught that. We're basically taught to stay uninvolved with our patients for the most part because we're scientists. I remember when I was going to school, I was taught that. Now, I do think things are changing a little bit. I think that there is a move that's huge that's saying, hey, these are people. We need to treat people as human beings. And yes, they get sick and fine, but we shouldn't be just focusing on the disease they have.
I think people are calling on this more and more now that the internet is so popular because people are looking up their conditions and their symptoms and their medications. Well, so they're challenging their doctors a little more.
Well, they want to participate and they want to be involved with making important decisions. I mean, doctors, for the most part, have a free rein to do what they want. And now when you have HMO medicine and hospitals that own doctors and employ them, those doctors don't have the ability to do all the things that they want to do.
They have to follow the protocols. They have to do what the health insurance companies
do. Well, that's right. And so whoever pays the bills controls what kind of treatment is given. And if it's not available because nobody's going to pay for it, then you've got a real problem. So doctors have become more like employees who will follow the directions of their superiors, and that's the way it is.
And that's certainly anything but patient-centered care. That's just following the guidelines. That is the patient in room 422 with the gallbladder.
That's right, and you can treat the one that's in 436 down the hall with gallbladder the same way. Even though they're different people with different needs, with different stories, different life stories, and we should be paying attention to the whole thing. It's not just about treating a set of symptoms with a bag of tools. It's about being with people rather than doing things to them. It's about listening and caring. It's about sharing and having a relationship that's a real relationship, not one that's distanced and scientific because we're afraid we can't stay detached and objective about what we do. I think that's BS. I think we give much better care when we care about what's happening.
Another thing that I think is kind of scary in the system that we have is that social services can actually force treatments, like with kids, for example.
Oh, yeah.
If the parents don't want the child to have chemotherapy, for example, they can force it. They can take the kids away from you. And I think you had some patients that had AIDS, and it was a similar situation.
Well, the control of what happens is not always in the hands of the parent or of the patient themselves. So things can be forced on people. We need to take back our dignity and our responsibility to care for ourselves. We need to get away from all these things that are just rote, that HMOs and big systems are saying this is what you do for that. And most of it's what? It's about pharmaceutical drugs and technologies. It's not about lifestyle. I mean, everybody mentions that in passing because they almost feel like they have an obligation to do it. But in fact, that's not what happens. I mean, it's not like the patients are really encouraged in a meaningful way. They're not given courses or given training that's really serious training about how to do that.
They can listen to shows like ours.
Well, absolutely. We could do something at the national level to create ways that we could fund education that teaches people about lifestyle. And yet, because this country is so engrossed in making money, we like the idea economically of people being sick because that generates tons of income. If we're all well, I mean, the cost of keeping people well is minuscule. If you ate right, slept right, reduced your stress levels, exercised every day, had a decent weight, and had a meaningful purpose in your life, what the hell would you need a doctor for?
If you do need a doctor
or a drug
and you are in the hospital, I think there are some things that are good for people to be aware of and to know about so that they can ask the doctors or they can tell the doctors how they feel about it without just going along with the whole program.
That's exactly
like, for
right.
example, you didn't want to have a blood transfusion.
That's
you
right.
didn't even want a blood transfusion of your own blood.
That's
tell
right.
us why.
Well, you know, when your own blood is kept around for a couple of weeks, which it is, it oxidizes and it changes. It's not the same thing as what's in your bloodstream because there's nothing keeping it in its natural state. So why would I want to take blood that's been damaged by oxidation by sitting in some plastic bag that's outgassing stuff that I don't want in me either? Why would I want to do that, particularly if I could get along without it? And would I want a blood transfusion from someone else? Oh, my God, not unless I was on my deathbed.
You'd have to be really hemorrhaging badly.
I'd have to be in a life or death situation before I'd accept a transfusion. Okay. I think that's a huge thing to do. That's extremely dangerous.
Okay, another thing is sometimes when people have surgery, they put a catheter in them. And I think that it's nice to ask them if they would be gentle when they do it and maybe use an extra small one so that
depending
it doesn't,
on the situation,
don't have
for
problems
an older
afterwards.
Person.
If they're going to be intubated for general anesthetic, ask them to put it in gently even though you're already out because later a lot of people have sore throats. And also if you want to refuse certain medications or treatments, you know, you need to ask and it's okay to do that.
Well, I think it's important to participate with your doctor. There's no question. You have a responsibility to do that, and the doctor has a responsibility to listen to what you want. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Senior citizens were sitting around talking about all their ailments. My arms have gotten so weak I can hardly lift this cup of coffee, said one of them. Yes, I know, said another. My cataracts are so bad I can't even see my coffee. Well, I couldn't even mark an X at election time. My hands are so crippled, volunteered a third. What? Speak up? What? I can't hear you. I can't turn my head because of the arthritis in my neck, said a fourth, to which several nodded weakly in agreement. My blood pressure pills make me so dizzy. I forget where I am and where I'm going, said another. I guess that's the price we pay for getting old, winced an old man as he slowly shook his head, and the others nodded in agreement. Well, count your blessings, said a woman cheerfully. Thank God we can all still drive.
Oh, jeez. That's great. That's going from the frying pan into the fire. Yeah, when some people drive, I'd like them to give me a call first so I know they're on the road and I can stay off of it. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, here's another study on epigenetics showing that we can change our genetic predisposition. And this one's on the genetic tendency to obesity. Now, the Public Library of Science article shows that our gene is 30% weaker if we exercise. Pretty good, huh?
Well, it's nice to know that a lot of the work that was really highlighted by Bruce Lipton in his book, The Biology of Belief, is true. And what he's basically saying is, look, you all think that your DNA and your genes are immutable, meaning they do not change, they're fixed, there's nothing you can do about it, you're doomed to whatever they are when you're born. Turns out to be the furthest thing from the truth. What you do with your life, how you live it, how much sleep you get, how much exercise you do, what kind of foods you eat, how much you weigh, all have a profound effect on what? How your genes will develop, how they will express themselves, how DNA will change to accommodate how you're dealing with your environment and what your lifestyle is. And that's big news. When you can change a gene that affects obesity and your tendency to eat by 30% by just exercising, that's good news.
Get out there, start walking around the block.
Yeah, when you can eat more fruits and vegetables and find that your heart will function better, will have less of a tendency to develop arteriosclerosis in it, that's big news.
There were other ones also, studies on prostate cancer showing that lifestyle could change the DNA toward that propensity.
Yeah, this was Dean Ornish's work probably maybe a year ago now, where he showed that if you change people who have cancer, prostate cancer, by doing better diet, exercise, stress reduction, yoga, et cetera, that they turned off the cancer genes. There were 500 cancer genes that followed. And if they did that for just 3 months, the cancer genes didn't any longer promote the cancer. That's big news. DNA is changeable. Our genetic expression is very vulnerable and responsive to our environment.
Well, there was another study that showed that early mortality risk is reduced by as much as 40% through exercise of at least 2.5 hours a week.
Yeah, so these are all big things that do enormous changes to our DNA and our genes and set the stage for us to be able to live lives that are much better. So when we talk about lifestyle being the most powerful medicine there is, there's no doubt about that.
So get up off the couch.
Yeah, right. Get off the couch. Get away from that computer.
Get outside of that lounge chair.
That's right. Because that's powerful stuff. If we had medicines that could do what lifestyle did, they would be blockbuster drugs in about a tenth of a second. You wouldn't need direct-to-consumer ads. Everybody'd be stepping over everybody else to buy the pill. And yet, when you can do it yourself and you don't take that advice and you listen to the direct-to-consumer ads and they're telling you, here, we got a pill for everything. You got a problem with your heart? Take this one. You're depressed? Take that one. You're constipated? Take this one. You can't urinate? Take that one. I mean, we got a pill for everything.
And then plus you have this side effect, take this pill for that side effect. You get another side effect, take this one.
Well, you add it all up, and what you're talking about is a disaster of side effects. And the average American over the age of 65 is taking at least 4 prescription drugs. My God, how those interact and what they do in terms of side effects is mind-boggling
when you went to the hospital at 71, they were shocked that you weren't on any medications.
Oh, I know. Yeah, at age 71, I said, no, I'm not taking any medicines at all. They said, what? What do you mean you're not taking any medicines? I said, I'm not taking any medicines. And then I told them I didn't want them to give me any without asking me first if I wanted to take it, because I know what a lot of them do. And so when it came to... I mean, they learned not to prescribe much for me. Well, I took my pain pills for a few days. That helped.
Yes, and plus they gave you a blood thinner, and then they gave you this horrible razor blade, God. And you decided you were going to shave.
I wanted to look good for you when I was coming home. Boy, it looked like a Halloween treat.
He took the towel to dry his face and looked at the towel and almost passed out from looking at all the blood in the washcloth. So
well. There are a lot of things that we just do by rote habit. We should be thinking about them. We should be looking at the model of healthcare that we have and saying, how can we make it better? And then standing by it. But the problem is that when we get sick, we're very scared. And fear drives us where? Back to our doctors. It's not to usually our complementary and alternative doctors. And it shouldn't be one or the other anyway. It should be a blend.
Integrative.
Yeah. I mean, do the least invasive thing first. And that's almost always lifestyle. And when you live a healthy lifestyle and that doesn't work, then use non-invasive therapies. If that doesn't work, try supplements and herbs and simple things like that. And if that doesn't work, go ahead and use a pill, a pharmaceutical drug, if the odds are that it has a chance of helping you. There are lots of things to be thinking about besides just aggressive things that we do in mainstream medicine. We are so aggressive with what we do that we forget that there are non-aggressive ways that are better than the aggressive ones, that are safer, more affordable, and actually work. That's what we should be thinking about. But we're slow. And little by little, as more information's coming out, we're beginning to take note of some of the things that are happening in our traditional mainstream medicine and realizing that we need to expand our options to include any discipline that can support making us healthier.
And the time to start learning it is now, before you get sick.
Well, that's right, because after you're sick, then you're going to be doomed probably to be thinking about the mainstream system, especially if you've had a heart attack or a bleeding ulcer or kidney failure or some other big thing, which is now commonplace. We've got so many sick people around who are depending on the silver bullets that are advertised in direct-to-consumer ads that we just assume that that's the way to go. Well, it's not the only way to go. And it's not to be thrown out either. I mean, the wonders of modern medicine, I say every week on the show, are stunning, but they're not primary care. They're what we do after primary care might not work, or if you've had some bad luck with something. So we need to keep it simple, you know, the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid. It really does apply. And if we do that, we're going to be a heck of a lot more functional and a lot happier, because we're not going to be sick. It's pretty straightforward on how to be healthy. And we haven't bought into that enough. We're thinking it, we're aware of it, and we're convinced that it's the way to go. But when we get sick, we still go back and look for our silver bullets and our doctors.
Well, sometimes people are so afraid to go to their doctors that they wait too long.
Well, that's true, too.
Sometimes there are things that can be helped or prevented.
Totally. So let's just be open-minded. Little Chinese medicine, maybe some Native American medicine. Maybe we do the things that, like homeopathy or body work or things that are not real mainstream.
Chiropractic.
And just keep them as something like that.
You know, many times, I'm going to change the subject here.
Mm-hmm.
People like to have a drink for dinner at night or something, you know. But here's an interesting study showing that less than one alcoholic drink per day can lead to small intestinal bacteria overgrowth and malabsorption of nutrients and lead to bloating and gas and abdominal pain and diarrhea. So tell us about the difference between the small and the large intestine and their roles and how this could happen.
Okay, well, basically what you're asking me to define is, what does small bowel overgrowth syndrome mean? Normally, most of the bacteria we have are in the colon. Okay, that's where they flourish. The small intestine has a few bacteria, but not a lot. But when it does overgrow with bacteria, particularly ones that are not the healthiest ones, it can lead to lots of problems.
The alcohol isn't going to kill them.
The alcohol, it's going to select out a lot of those microbes that are the ones that you don't want living there that are going to cause symptoms. That's what this article is saying. So if you have a tendency towards the IBS-like syndrome, and it's caused by small bowel overgrowth of microbes in it, then alcohol is probably going to make it worse. So I wouldn't be thinking about using alcohol in that setting.
So, and they're talking about 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of 80-proof.
Yeah. So it would be one
alcohol.
Drink for women and 2 drinks for men.
I said sometimes it's even less than that would cause the symptoms. So anyway, if you have those symptoms, you might look to that.
Well, that's right. And if you have a tendency towards low gastric acidity because you're taking this silly purple pill, or you have reduced peristaltic activity for some reason because you're sick, or you have damage to the mucosa of the small intestine, these are the people that tend to get this small bowel overgrowth syndrome. And if you want more information about it, again, I recommend you go to drsaputo.com, put small bowel overgrowth in the search box, and up will come a video that talks about what is it, how do you treat it, how do you diagnose it, and all that business. So it's something that is more common than we recognize, and it is something that is treatable, but it's difficult to treat. And a lot of people have a real hard time with it, but most doctors have never even heard of it or know what to do how to look for it to make the diagnosis. There are so many things that we do in nutritional medicine that are superior to what the gastroenterologists do. You know, they're dead set on fighting against any microbe or any kind of disease that we have in the gut. For example, if you have C. diff enterocolitis,
antibiotics.
So you've been in the hospital for 2 weeks, they've given you oral antibiotics, you've wiped out the flora, and somehow what grows back is what? It's the C. difficile enterocolitis microbe. And that raises hell because it causes ulcers and bleeding and a lot of mucus production and sometimes perforations. Yeah, I'd say a lot of people die from that in the hospital. It's one of those infections that's responsible for the 1.7 million people who get a hospital-acquired infection and the 100,000 people who die. This is one of the big ones that does that. And so what do the gastroenterologists do? They give you vancomycin and some other things to try and suppress the growth of the bacteria, the C. diff bacteria, to try and kill it. What do I do in that setting? Is I treat with things to support the gut. I'll give L-glutamine, which is a major metabolic fuel of the gut. Things like Saccharomyces boulardii, which crowds out the unfriendly yeast there that tends to protect against C. diff forming. Maybe some ultra clear sustain. Certainly give a probiotic. All those things work better than doing the warlike stuff that the gastroenterologists
do. And can't vancomycin cause some serious effects?
It can, but fortunately it's not well absorbed through the gut, so that's not a huge issue.
Great,
but yeah, you're giving
that.
A very powerful and toxic drug that we have to be careful about. So I know I was referred about 5 or 6 patients when I was practicing at my local hospital a few years ago who had C. diff enterocolitis because I have a big mouth, and I also said that I knew how to treat that. So they gave me their patients who'd been in the hospital 6 weeks and said, okay, Mr. Smart Guy, see if you can fix these. Fix them all. What did that result in?
They never sent
no
you anymore.
No more referrals. It's like, it's amazing. Okay, and now, 10 years
so
later.
So how would you explain why they didn't? What do you think why
ego.
They didn't?
That was ego. And they figured they could do it themselves, and so they were going to try and do what they did, and they didn't want to hear or learn about anything I was doing.
But they sent them to you. One of them sent his wife to you.
Well, yeah, and they get better almost across the board. Now, I'm sure there's going to be a case one day that, you know, I can't treat like that because nothing works 100% of the time. But these are brilliant ways of supporting wellness as opposed to trying to kill some bug or stop some process that's making you sick. And, of course, we should be looking at both of those as options and using them when it's appropriate. So it's not like I think vancomycin and cholestyramine should never be used to treat C. diff enterocolitis. I might be the first one to try that for a couple of days first. I might be. Chances are I won't normally, because these other non-invasive approaches that are totally safe, that don't hurt anybody, do work. So why not keep it simple and do what works? And in the process, we can go ahead and we can educate our gastroenterologists. They're learning some things here. They're now talking probiotics, whereas 10 years ago,
yeah,
they were trying to tell me I was some kind of nut. They said, that doesn't do anything. We don't have any data on that. And I said, well, there is data on that, and it's in your journals, but you're not reading it, sonny boy.
Okay.
So here we are.
So here's your last chance. If you have any calls, if you have any questions about your health, yeah, it's 888-874-4888.
Okay, let's do one more thing.
If you could decrease your feelings of hunger, feel happier, and improve your heart health, would you be willing to add 1 ounce of mixed nuts that are raw, unpeeled walnuts or almonds or hazelnuts a day to your diet? Well, tell us about this study and how just a few nuts can help people with metabolic syndrome.
Well, it can also help people who are not doing well generally with their gut. And what the nuts do is increase the production of serotonin in the gut. And serotonin is that feel-good hormone, that neurotransmitter, that if we don't have enough of, tends to make us feel depressed. Well, the gut makes more serotonin than the brain does. There's a shock for you. So we have something called the gut-brain, okay, that uses these neurotransmitters that makes a big difference in how the gut acts. So when we eat 1 ounce a day of nuts, we find that the serotonin metabolites in urine go up, and we wind up with a much healthier gut. And what we also find is that helps people with metabolic syndrome by decreasing their feelings of hunger, making them feel happier, improving heart health, and, of course, making for a healthy GI tract. So, you know, nuts are something that have a lot of essential fatty acids, the omega-3s and 6s, but they also have other important fats that are healthy for us. They're a good food that, in general, because they're high in calories, we tend to avoid. But at the same time, these are things that it really help keep us in good shape. What I say for a healthy diet is fruits and vegetables, seeds and nuts, herbs and spices. That makes for a really healthy diet. And use many different colors each day of these foods so that you can get the best balance that you can. And that's what it takes to have a really healthy diet. So when we're looking at diet, we have to look at a lot of factors. It's not just something that's in a package. I tend to avoid foods that come in a package because they're not foods anymore. What they are is they're chemicals that have been put into a cellophane package that many times have words that I can't interpret, I can't read or understand. And so we have to do something about avoiding those things and eating real food. So we should be looking at the kinds of things that will help to keep us natural. So if it looks like a watermelon or a zucchini, do it. Anyway, that's what I think about diet. Now, we'd like to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news in health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.com and on DrSaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Standard Time. They'll also be archived on DrSaputo.com.
And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life. Now, go out and have a great day.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.